Welcome to Crosstalk. I'm Corey Rabin. Happy that you're joining us today. If you like the episode that you're about to hear, do me a favor. Do me a personal favor. Ring that bell. Like, subscribe. Tell us what you like. Tell us what you don't like. Tell us what you need more of, and then we're going to give it to you. We're going to give it to you as best as we can. And you know, the only way I know how to do that well is to introduce you to Irene Lignos. Hey, Irene.
Hey, Corey. How are you?
You ready to rock and roll?
Ready to rock and roll. Very exciting.
We got a great guest today.
I know.
Tanner Strickland is with us. Hey, Tanner.
Hey, how's it going, guys?
Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
We're in LA on our LA run, and this is Music Day.
Yeah.
So we got,
that's what I hear.
Oh, we got a heavy hitter music person right in front of us right now.
We'll see.
So, Tanner, where you grew up in what town?
I'm from a town called Nashville, Georgia. It's in South Georgia, just north of the Florida line. The closest bigger city to us is Valdosta. It's about 30 minutes away, but the town I'm from is a farming community, probably about 5,000 people, maybe 20,000 in the county.
What was it like growing up there?
It was great. My parents are still together. That's where my mom's family still lived when I was growing up, so getting to grow up with my grandparents and things like that, and then all the things that you can't do in the city was, you know, at our fingertips, as far as riding four-wheelers and going out to somebody's farm and just messing around all day and not really having to worry about other people, you know.
So what was it like growing up there?
Everybody knew everybody, for sure. My mom's dad owned a department store before I was born, and he had four daughters that all worked there, and that was like before Walmart and everything. So he sold affordable clothing for kids going back to school and things like that. So I think everybody kind of knew our family from that. And my dad's side of the family, my granddad was a dairy farmer that kind of settled in that area when my dad was in eighth grade. So being born into that community where everybody knows you, whether you've met them or not, you know, there were people that I met when I was 20 years old that were like, you look exactly like your grandfather. And it's like, that's just a crazy thing that doesn't happen, I feel like, a lot of places. So it's really, you know, a unique experience.
So would you say that just kind of being in that environment has shaped who you are now?
Definitely.
Did any of that influence kind of why we're here today?
I think so. I think being in that environment, like I said, where everybody knows everyone, you don't always want everybody to know your business, especially when you're not living in a way that aligns with your core values. And that's what I was doing a lot of times. So I feel like I really developed that. I would, you know, put on a mask for people a lot of times. Just like I said, you don't want everybody to know your business. And especially when you start struggling with some of the stuff I've struggled with, anytime you do appear down or like you're going through something, it automatically jumps to he's using again, or, you know, things like that. So, and a lot of times it was, but,
when did you start using?
So my drug use started in the doctor's office. I, maybe I drank a couple times before that, but I tore my shoulder. I played football, in college also, but when I was a freshman in high school, I tore up my shoulder for the first time, was prescribed Percocet.
What did you tear?
My rotator cuff. Yeah, labrum, shoulder stuff.
That's what I'm currently handling.
Yeah. In the labrum you need surgery for. Rotator, sometimes you can get away without
it. Yeah, and it was one of those situations. I was doing it, you know, thinking about a football career, and I probably could have done without the surgery at that point. I was so young and in ways I wish I would have, but that was my first experience with the drug that I eventually fell in love with.
How old were you? Your first freshman?
14, yeah.
You're 14. So you were doing Percocet. Did you do it more than you were prescribed?
No, I think at the beginning it was pretty much as the label told me to, but I do remember like a specific time where it stopped making me drowsy and started switching into like, I can actually get a lot of stuff done. And
you had any alcohol at this time?
Yeah, it was around that same time that I probably had my first drinks. It wasn't like every weekend at that point. I think the next year the partying and, you know, friends with cars and stuff like that.
So it's planted the seed that you like that.
Yeah. And I think it was all like based in, I put a lot of pressure on myself with football and music and grades and all that type stuff. So that alcohol always took a little longer, but the opiate, you know, it really, it helped me with physical pain, but I think it was that emotional and spiritual pain that I was trying to block out that it really kind of let me let my hair down a little bit, so to speak.
And who'd you let your hair down with?
All my buddy, everybody I could. That was also, you know, I've played music since I was a kid. I started in the church playing piano, and then when I got in middle school, started playing guitar and got into Grateful Dead and stuff like that. So I was hanging out with these older kids that were doing a lot more things than I was. But I feel like music really kind of gave me a reason to be at some of those parties.
And then, did you have more comfort performing in front of people because of that?
I think so. And it was also, I came from performing in the church growing up, you know, playing like church style classical piano and then eventually more contemporary praise music and stuff like that. But it was always, you know, when you talk about letting your hair down, that's not exactly what I was doing in church. I got a good feeling from it, but when I got out there to those parties and I was playing the stuff I liked. And
yeah, I mean, in church, the music you're playing, everyone likes that music.
Yeah, right.
It's not like they say, well, you know what? I'm not really looking for the religious stuff. It's not going to happen.
Yeah. And I think for somebody like me who already enjoyed that feeling of escaping, being able to do that and make people like me at the same time, which is, you know, one of my big defects is like people pleasing and being able to let my hair down, like we say, and play music and people like that was just like, it really set me off. It really set that ego ablaze too.
When did things start to kind of accelerate for you?
So I would say just a little bit about football. I played growing up, football and music, small town. That was all there was for me to do. And I'm really thankful for that. There wasn't a lot of trouble for me to get into as far as legally or anything like that. But I've always been larger than a lot of people. And once I got to middle school, it kind of became apparent that I had a future with football. And my sophomore year, I got offered by the University of Georgia and had like the real conversation with my dad. We were Auburn fans. My dad.
I had a feeling you were going to say that. I don't know.
My dad was a walk-on in Auburn. So I grew up an Auburn fan. But when Georgia offered and me living in Georgia, dad kind of sat me down and was like, you know, more than likely you're going to be living in the state when you get out of college. And it's kind of like the first business talk I ever had. Like it could really help your future if you went to the in-state school where, you know, in the state of Georgia, red and black, everybody bleeds it. Everybody's dog fans, especially here recently with the success that they've had. But I got offered after my sophomore year and I decided to go ahead and commit to Coach Rick and the Bulldogs. And up to that point, that was something I was really like striving to do, but I didn't expect it to happen so early. And I got really fortunate. One of the guys I played against was a big recruit and I did pretty well against him. And after that commitment, I think it was like a week after I turned 16 is when I committed. So then I had a car and I had that checked off. So I started really not caring about what I was doing and was able to drink every weekend and still somehow.
You already had in your pocket what you were looking for.
Yeah.
So you had like a free year or two to do whatever the hell you wanted.
Yeah. And it was just that age where girls and drinking and, you know, smoking some pot and maybe going down to the college bars on the weekend if we could get away and borrow some IDs and stuff like that. As well as, you know, that was 2005 when I committed and right at the kind of beginning of like high-speed internet and these like recruiting sites that I was kind of thrust into this like national database of football players where I would go to a game in Athens where the University of Georgia is and 100,000 people would know who I was. And I was 15, 16 years old, you know.
That's definitely an ego boost.
An ego boost. And I didn't understand like how it would affect me down the line. But that also added to always having to wear that mask and keep up a guard, because especially in, you know, the football world, you can't really, you don't bring up your feelings and emotions a lot and things like that. So I really had to, I would always tell myself to like put your best foot forward, even if, you know, things suck right now. So
any drug and alcohol consequences in that 2 year period?
So the when I first got to Athens, and this was probably like a really big moment, is I got busted in this weird fake ID ring the second month I was there. And I was 17, about to start spring practice. And it was just something crazy. Like the state of Florida used to auction off their DMV machines, and these kids in Atlanta got a hold of it. And then they were dispersing these IDs all over the country to these universities. And the batch that I was with busted open somewhere in Arizona. And they called my coaches and basically made it seem like if I cooperated, nothing would happen to me because I knew I played football. Turns out, since I cooperated, I was the only one that turned in my fake ID, and I was the only one that got charged, including the people that made them. And
wow. That, talk about doing the right thing.
Yeah, I mean, and I didn't know any better, you know, and I don't think anybody could have. I don't blame the coaches for giving me the advice to cooperate, because, I mean, honestly, I probably would have anyway, just because that's the type of person I've, you know, I've always been. But that's where my cover got blown for the first time, because I think up to that point, like, yeah, people probably knew I was drinking on the weekends in high school, but I still saved face. I still went to church with my parents every Sunday. I still played music for the church from time to time. But then I was on the front page of the college newspaper, and as soon as that ran, I was on the front page of all the newspapers in the state. This 17-year-old kid that was a big-time recruit got arrested before his first spring practice, you know.
I mean, I feel like, though, where I grew up, having a fake ID at 13 was normal, you know?
Yeah.
I had one at 13, you know, and so did half my year. So in a way, I feel like that's a part of the growing pains.
Yeah, I think so, too. And I think a lot of people gave me a lot of grace for that. I didn't catch a lot of flack from people. I think I was really hard on myself just because I felt like, you know, all my secret life of drinking was out there, and only got to use the ID once. but it was just, you know, one of those things. It really, I felt like it tainted my image with the coaches. And I think to that point, like, and I always did try to be like a good person, but I kind of got a rap as maybe a bad boy, even though that was not what I was going for. But, you know, I ended up being the party guy on the team after that.
You didn't end up being the party guy on the team after that because of that. You were the party guy on the team.
Oh yeah, I was the party guy on the team, and I got exposed. So it made it easier for me to lean into that and not try to cover it up as much. I think especially with coaches and.
So freshman year, did you go to 4 years of school?
I did.
And was drinking and drugging something that accelerated, or were you able to keep it under control?
Definitely drinking. My freshman year, I redshirted, which means I didn't travel with the team to away games, and I had a lot of free time on the weekends. So I spent a lot of time with the fraternity guys on the side of town that they hung out in, and that exposed me to, you know, things that people who didn't have to go to practice every day were doing. But it was mainly drinking, you know, some cocaine here and there. Pot was always the tricky one playing ball, because we got drug tested pretty often, you know, stays in your system. But
what about opiates, since that was kind of, so, you know, Percocet seemed to be a gateway?
That was always, after high school, that was something I would do when I didn't really know where to get them until guys on the team started having surgeries. And so somebody was always prescribed them, and a lot of those guys didn't like to take them. And then in 2009, I tore my rotator cuff again. That would have been going into my redshirt sophomore year. And to that point, the summer before that, I was the strongest player on the team. I'd broken a lot of records in the weight room. And I, the whole time, like you said, I had coaches telling me, like, you got a problem. Like, you need to go talk to somebody. But I knew that on paper, I had good grades. I was excelling in the weight room. And more than likely, I was going to play a good bit in the fall. So I knew that they didn't, you know, until something really bad happened, they didn't really have a reason to do anything or punish me. But when that, you know, I tore up my shoulder before that 2009 season, which really put me down. And going back to the first surgery, just the way they did that surgery changed a lot. And I had a lot of atrophy that made the surgery not take the way it should have. And again, I didn't travel with the team in 2009. And that's when the opiates really, I had a prescription as well as, you know, hanging out with some guys that didn't have my best interest in mind. And I didn't either. I didn't have my
own. 09 was your junior year?
It would have been my redshirt sophomore year, but junior year in school. Yeah.
Any of your friends or people that you knew as you went along die?
Yes. Yes, for sure. You know, there's been a handful of guys that I played ball with, and I'm not sure exactly what the circumstances were around them. I know most of them struggled with some kind of addiction. I think there's been some suicide. And then also just being in the bar scene, playing music, a lot of alcoholic deaths, just people pickling their liver and going out that way. Some of my closest friends, and then just accidents that happen while you're intoxicated, you know. Just crazy stuff. One of my buddies got hit by a car and passed that way. And one of my musician buddies. But yeah, I mean, it takes, you hang around, and I guess I've kind of been around the rooms. I wouldn't say I've ever worked a program until this sobriety, but you know, you hang around for a while and you really, people start falling off pretty quickly.
Do you ever think that, you know, you're one of the lucky guys that with so many people having died from the different, I mean, all different kinds of ways, but way before they should have.
Yeah.
You ever scratch your head and say, why me and why am I blessed?
Yeah, for sure. Especially all the times that, you know, I feel like I should have been dead, wrecking cars, and I haven't gotten to it. But when I was 11 months sober in this sobriety, I got hit by a car when I was on my e-bike. And I was in the hospital for a month.
You were sober?
I was sober.
Why were you in the hospital for a month?
I broke 6 ribs, seven vertebrae, or seven some kind of.
Did you have a helmet on?
I did not. I didn't hit my head. I should have had a helmet on.
That's oh my God, my whole face went pale.
But helmets don't look cool, you know?
they don't.
Neither does 7 vertebrae. But
my shoulder still gives me problems, and it's the same shoulder that I injured in football. But I was in the hospital for a month and got out 2 days before I took my cake at my home group. So that was kind of one of the things that was motivating me to, you know, I was in a situation where I had to have opiates in the hospital, under the doctor's care. I didn't take any that I wasn't supposed to. And it was a scary, scary situation to go through.
So you're in a position where, I haven't heard that you went off the rails with opiates. I know, you know, we got to the point that, you know, you're celebrating a year after you got out of the hospital. Let's just backtrack a little
right,
bit.
Yeah.
How did things kind of get really off the rails, and what are the circumstances that led up to you making good decisions?
So getting done, graduating college, getting done playing football, where I, you know, had so many people managing me and making sure that I was here, then here, then here. And that was my whole life up to that point. I was 21 when I graduated. It was just like that sigh of relief of like, all right, I can sleep in today and not, you know, I can wake up and smoke weed and not worry about a drug test, all that. Like,
no job after school?
So that first, the first crazy thing I did, and I say I graduated December 2010. What I really did was I failed a class on purpose so I could still get scholarship checks for the following semester to pay my rent and stay in Athens. So it was like a calculated class fail.
It was primarily to party more.
Yeah, to party, to play music. I just gotten to where I could play music and not have the coaches, you know, breathing down my neck. And then, you know, that's when I stopped having to say no to a lot of substances. And also during that time, as I started to play music a good bit, I didn't have a job, but I was playing music. And I think I always kind of romanticized the lifestyles of the rock stars and, you know, people that didn't live very long in reality. But once that became an option for me, and also as a creative, like at the beginning, you think those things enhance your creativity. And maybe they gave me some fodder for like the stories I tell in my music, but man, once it really takes off like that, it just began to take and take. And I was still drinking a lot at that time. And I would say 2013, I got put in the hospital with pancreatitis, and it was severe. I was in intensive care and hooked up to a steady Dilaudid drip for like 2 weeks, and was not warned. Up to that point, I'd been snorting OxyContin, but I'd never really gotten off the rails, like you said. But I was sent out of the hospital after that Dilaudid drip with no warning.
With nothing else.
So you with went nothing. Well, I had like some, some painkillers, but they didn't last very long. But I was in withdrawal, like severe withdrawal, yeah. And I wasn't warned about it.
Would you have been in withdrawal but for the fact that you already had been taking opiates before you got there?
Yeah, I remember some like withdrawal from the OxyContin, but maybe I wasn't using that much or use it every day. It's hard to remember, but nothing like it was when I got out of the hospital with the drip. And I was younger too, and maybe that I was still working out. Like maybe it just passed through my body.
So what'd you do when you got out?
I got out and went full steam ahead into my addiction. I mean, I sat at my parents' house for a few days after I got out of the hospital, and I would trying to take these small painkillers they gave me to ease my pain, but it wasn't pain from the pancreatitis, it was withdrawals. And I really couldn't differentiate at that time because I just didn't know what it felt like to be in such bad withdrawals. And then as soon as I got to a buddy's house, and I think I smoked some opium, and that was like an immediate, that was the first time I'd ever smoked opiates, I think. And that was like that immediate release of just like the withdrawal was gone. The pain from the pancreatitis was gone. I was in a good mood. And after that, like that was what I was going for. The fastest way I could get it in my system. And sometimes it was smoking and sometimes it was shooting it.
Are you 21?
2013, I would have been 23.
So take us from 23 to, the bottom.
So by that time I had started my first band out of college. I think we started in 2012 and we picked up, we were able to stay busy. I always also supplemented my income by playing acoustic shows anywhere I was at with the band. So sometimes I would play two or three shows in a day, including the band show at night. And we did that. Just about, we were like weekend warriors. And then I did my restaurant gigs during the week, and I was doing that for 5 years, probably 2013 to 2018, and just playing. But I was just so caught up in the addiction, and I was also doing a lot of cocaine, pretty much any upper I could get.
That's how you have to. Can only do a restaurant job.
Yeah, it's funny because, I probably did, realistically, I probably did more cocaine than I ever did opiates, but it was just something that was always there and kept me going. And when I came to treatment, I never mentioned cocaine, but then it's like, yeah, you did it all day, every day for a decade. That's probably something you have an issue with.
It's expensive too.
Super expensive. But also playing music, there's a lot of people willing to give you whatever you want, especially when it means that's what gets you on the stage. And I was always like the front guy, lead singer, sometimes lead guitar player. So it was pretty important that I was on stage. So I had people that didn't have any kind of substance use problems, finding drugs for me just to make sure I wasn't up there just dragging ass, Excuse me, I didn't mean to curse, but.
No, ass is okay. We actually, you can say fuck and
okay, sweet.
Anything you really want to say.
Awesome. No, I'm never sure.
So, at this point, we're in 2018. You are full-fledged.
Yeah, just
opiate,
like
upper, all
opiates. And I wouldn't say I had a death wish, but I think in the back of my mind, I kind of assumed that was how I would go out.
I felt the same.
A lot of close calls, no like overdoses that I would have named an overdose at that time, but there were probably some that I slept through and somehow woke up, gasping for air and things like that. But in 2018, I started dating a girl that was a little younger than me, and really, really sweet girl that really saw the worst parts of me. But I wanted to back off of the really hard stuff. And that's when I was like, I'm just going to snort these Roxys. And it ended up being fake fentanyl pills. Ooh. And that led me into COVID where music completely shut down. And up to that point, that was all I'd done since college was play music.
So, I mean, you're full-fledged fentanyl addiction now in COVID. And I mean, you're lucky you're alive.
Definitely. Definitely. I mean, there's a lot of days that I was there by myself just using all day.
Takes like one tiny bit, right?
Yeah.
How long did that relationship last?
So up until I came out here in 2022 for the first time, and that was kind of where I was like, all right, this has to, I've got to stop dragging her through my bullshit. And
was she there for it or was she trying to save you?
Well, all right. So I got arrested in 2021, knotted out at the steering wheel, like a block away from my house. And that's pretty much what started me taking getting sober seriously. I had several substances on me. I went to jail. I was back in the newspaper and on the news.
How long were you in jail for?
Just a few days or 2 days, maybe. Like not even that.
Did it impact you when you got out to change?
It did, and especially because once I got out, I was already in the news because I remember calling my girlfriend from the jail and being like, let's not let anybody know about this. And she was like, well, everybody knows. You know, you're on the paper and on the 6 o'clock news. So when I got out, I wanted nothing more than to go to rehab. Like, I just wanted to get away.
And where are you geographically at this time?
I was in South Georgia, living in Valdosta, and I went to a treatment center in North Georgia in Blue Ridge Mountain Recovery Center. And that was like my first time of going to an AA meeting and actually like hearing things of like, listen, for the similarities, not the differences, just the little cliches like we were talking about. And even though I couldn't like, I didn't have the perspective to apply them yet. Because I think at this time, you know, like we all start out a lot of times, it was the physical aspect of my addiction that I thought was the problem, of course, like everybody thinks at first. And even the second, when I came out to Malibu for the first time, which was my second treatment after the arrest, I was still very physically addicted. And then the relapse before I came out here for this sobriety, I was only using like once or twice a week, maybe. My tolerance was really low, so I was really close to overdose a lot of times when I used. But I also, those days between me using, say days between payday is how I kind of looked at it, I really got that upfront view of the obsession and how I couldn't live, the unmanageability of it, because I mean, I couldn't get out of bed, constantly checking my phone, waiting on drug dealers, and just living a lie more than anything. And
you're still with this girl at the time?
I'm sorry to jump around. At that point, I was not with her anymore.
And so you're sober now over a year.
Yeah. It'll be 18 months on the 13th.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
How does it feel being a guy who's got some time under his belt and your head is clear? And for those people who are listening or wondering, you know, maybe this is for me, what's better?
Oh, sobriety is so much better. I mean, I wouldn't say at 18 months I've got anything figured out. I just can recognize more problems sometimes, it seems like. But I feel like I'm equipped to deal with them. You know, coming to 18 months, you hear a lot of people talk about like a lull or a plateau that they get. And I'm really trying to not enter that because I could feel it coming on at times. But you know, that's when I've really cranked up my program and trying to live in the last three steps. My relationship with my higher power is of utmost importance. You know, my morning routine is huge for me every day. And it feels good to start out the day that way and actually know that I have a relationship with God. Because I grew up in the church, and but when I thought I knew what God was, or when I listened to people say, this is what you need to believe, I didn't have any relationship with God. So I really had to let that go when I first came out here.
I wanted to ask you that earlier when you talked about, you know, growing up in the church and playing piano in the church and everything. So tell us a little bit about your morning routine, because I think it's really important for people to hear like what it looks like to be sober as opposed to chasing, you know.
Yeah. The main three things that have been consistent that I was able to start on as soon as I got a treatment was, you know, the gratitude list that everybody talk about. I trade gratitude lists with a bunch of friends every morning. And I like to do that list before I pray. And then I meditate after that. And then I try to write. I try to sit down with my guitar and see what comes out after that meditation. And mainly that morning prayer and meditation, I feel like kind of opens up that daily pathway between me and my higher power. And then out of that morning routine, there's so, you hear people talk about synchronicities, but there's so many things that it's just like, man, I was just pondering on that this morning, or I was just, you know, I was just thinking about that song. And when stuff like that happens, it really lights my path, and I take it as a sign that I'm on the right path and just another opportunity to pray and thank God. Gratitude is a, you know, such an important frequency and such a powerful frequency to start out with in the morning. And that's, you know, why I really value that morning routine.
So, you know, I think that one of the things that I ask everyone is if you could go back in time and tell your younger self, you know, choose what age, whether it's a piece of advice or just, you know, a cautionary, you know, tip, what age would you be, and what would you say?
I think it would be that age right before I decided to play football at Georgia, 14 or 15, and tell myself, not that I would listen back then, but I would tell myself that it's okay to ask questions. I think I always tried to appear like I understood what I was going through. And that's, you know, wearing that mask again, like I always wanted to appear stoic, or, you know, like I, you know, this doesn't affect me. I wanted to be good, but not look like I was trying too hard to be good. Mm-hmm. And I think I could have really benefited from asking more questions. And even, you know, we talked about the church thing. I always felt kind of guilty for asking questions in the community I grew up in.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank y'all.
Tanner, thanks so much. Irene, we're rocking and rolling through this LA run.
Yeah.
I'm really happy to be here, to meet you, and thanks so much for being here. And thank you for watching, and thanks for listening. And Crosstalk Podcast is coming back soon, so keep watching. Thanks a lot. We'll see you next time.
Life on the farm, and the soil's just as dry as sand. They say Uncle Sam took Mexico City for the land above the Rio Grande. Well, Mom's been sick, Daddy can't work a lick, and my brother is a wanted man. I'm gonna save up some money, go anywhere else, and I'm never looking back again. They signed the treaty, they say there's gold up in them hills, and there ain't nothing in this peanut town that's gonna keep up with the bills. My heart of Dixie will come with me as I chase the westward sun. I'm on the run in California by